In the first session, we looked at the broad span of the human mind with its faculties of perception. And we saw that potentially the human being has the capacity to comprehend reality beyond the dimensions of time and space. In this session, we are concerned to examine the spiritual pilgrimage, the journey of the soul, its means of progression, and what is meant by Christ-centeredness. In order to do this, I should like to share with you briefly something of my own spiritual journey, its peaks and valleys, cul-de-sacs, and sometimes vantage points of vision. At the age of 17, I was converted. Looking back over the years, it's not easy to assess the full significance of what happened. Yet I can still recall the intensity of emotions which accompanied that turning to Christ. Clearly, two important things did happen. They were important in terms of the spiritual pathway that I was to follow and of the direction it was to take. For two processes, eventually to become uncomfortable bedfellows and then incompatible, were dramatically and simultaneously brought to birth. The first of these processes was a commitment to a new and unfolding world of spiritual values. This was a world full of beckoning promise and potential. The second was the experience of being catapulted into the powerful and encapsulating world of religious dogma. I was entering a thought structure consisting of absolute certainties concerning the nature of God, humanity, and the universe. The first process was soon to require a continuous readjustment of thinking to ensure submission to this world of absolutes. And for many years, the second process was to control and direct the course of the first. The result was the systematic shaping of an inquiring and probing mind into an unquestioning conformity. It was many years later that I was to discover for myself the essential difference between the two processes and to allow the first that freedom which is of the very substance of true spiritual awakening. What is the nature of this awakening? In attempting to answer this question, we are confronted immediately with difficulty. For spiritual awakening is response to the action of a movement or dynamic. That is, the divine dynamic operating both within the human psyche and in human affairs. And a dynamic, by its very nature, defies and eludes definition. To attempt, therefore, to seal its meaning within a dogmatic formula is a contradiction in terms. You cannot capture a movement. This movement is capable of a multitude of expressions, and its modes of operation are beyond calculation. It cannot be trapped or held within any one category of manifestation. To attempt to do so is, in effect, to obscure those realities towards which it points and to which it gives authentic expression. It is to impose limits on the limitless. To realize this is to lay the foundations for a true ecumenism. Further, this movement cannot be determined or judged by any static form of identification, any more than the sun can be equated with one of its myriad rays. It is authenticated only by itself, for it is the truth which, says Jesus, shall set you free. Like the very nature of truth, spiritual awakening is primarily concerned not with intellectual concepts, but with the reality of a situation, every situation. Operating as the spearhead of a struggle between human egocentricity and divisiveness on the one hand, and the divine principle of wholeness on the other, it may be recognized within infinite diversity and behind any one of a thousand forms. Spirituality eludes not only definitions, but also the natural processes of comprehension, as we've already seen. It cannot be grasped by the intellect, for linear thinking can never comprehend the spiritual. Access to the world of spiritual reality is by the way of contradiction and paradox. As the Apostle Paul stated so unequivocally, the natural man, that is the sense-bound, does not understand the things of God, for they are spiritually discerned. Such discernment comes through the operation of penetrative or intuitive thought, and this emerges from the point where opposites come together. The intellectual processes, having reached an impasse, allow themselves to become stilled. And this, as we saw in the first session, produces the focusing of a new perception. For the mind, like a still, clear pool, then begins to reflect reality. So does spiritual discernment come to birth, and the path unfold. Such discernment constitutes an immediate recognition of the validity of paradox and the significance of apparent opposites. For it knows that although those human faculties which operate only in time and space can never themselves perceive the spiritual, yet it is through these very faculties that the dynamic is ever being articulated within human affairs. Proceeding from the world of ultimate reality, the spiritual world, it is ever working within these dimensions, that is, time and space, to illuminate and reconcile. Never stilled, this most powerful of all movements makes its presence known within human consciousness. And human beings are the prisms through which its myriad facets are focused on the planet. While speaking with a multitude of voices, the single word, love, may give it perfect utterance, and it is heard best of all in the silence of the heart. All this was perfectly illustrated by Jesus when he pointed Nicodemus towards the necessity of new birth, a phrase all too often trivialized today. Those who are born of the Spirit, he declared, are like the wind. No one knows from where it comes or where it goes, for it blows where it will. The essence of spiritual awakening, then, may be summed up as follows. It is the space to see, to be, to move, and quickly to outgrow those limitations which the pattern of our living has imposed upon us. Such an understanding makes it very clear that the dynamic of the spiritual being can never be identified with creedal statements, however perfectly expressed. Nor can it be contained within a catechism, however excellent its precepts. It is equally true that both creed and catechism, in particular situations and places, may give the dynamic perfect expression and articulation. For between movement and static form, there need be no contradiction, a reality perceived by mystics of all ages. Where then is the point of beginning for conscious awakening to this spiritual dimension? All of us must begin from exactly where we are and from within the context of our present understanding. Beliefs as such play no necessary part in such a beginning. Conversely, agnosticism provides no valid excuse for lack of response. Response to what? All that is necessary for movement, toward human fulfillment and humanity's true destiny is a readiness to respond to the beckoning of the highest that we know. It may well be that we shall quickly find that the highest becomes inadequate. No matter, for it will take us beyond itself to ever-widening vistas waiting to unfold within our consciousness. This is the nature of conversion. This is the essence of new birth. Is a conscious faith in God not then a necessary prerequisite for the beginning of such unfolding? To this, the answer must be no. If the desire for change, growth, fulfillment, whatever we may choose to call it, is there, then this is a clear indication that there is already an awakening from within. And what we call God is undoubtedly the initiator of the process. The word God represents that reality which may emerge under many names or none. Recognition of the reality may well lead to a clear expression of belief in God, but this plays no necessary part in spiritual awakening. Indeed, there are concepts of God which may inhibit or hinder the development of what is in fact a God-centered evolution of life from within, an aligning of the will with the dynamic. Movement with integrity contains the essence of belief. Movement with integrity contains the essence of belief. And reaching towards the highest that we know constitutes the advent of what the theologians call saving faith. Yet names and titles, theological or otherwise, have only secondary significance. The authentic face of God is love, and it was this which drew seekers after the dynamic so powerfully to Jesus of Nazareth. Their experience of his undifferentiating self-giving led them to declare, "We have seen the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." Many of us have unconsciously inherited images of a God who is out there and apart from the whole of creation. Yet the primary manifestation of divinity as divine love is in and through the created order. This is beautifully expressed in what is sometimes called the prologue of St. John's Gospel. Here, the whole universe is seen to be the outward vesture of a veiled but revealed divinity, or what has been called in the Christian tradition the cosmic Christ. It is an awareness of this which characterizes the spiritual consciousness rising within Western society today. The maelstrom of change has in many areas now subsided, and as we enter the last decade of the century, there are indications within society of frantic attempts to rebuild the contours of a rapidly disappearing world. The absence of the old sources of authority and the threat of global destruction are producing an unrelenting pressure upon human consciousness. And in this context, we are confronted with the choice of trying to re-establish the old or to move forward with the dynamic into a world of new realities. What are the signs of hope? Beneath the diversity of interpretations and the sometimes chaotic residue of past patterns of thought and behavior, creative new impulses are emerging. And these are refusing to operate within the confines of those separate compartments which have for so long divided humanity. The old structures of thought provided by religion, philosophy, and science cease to have meaning for human beings who are striving to align themselves with these new impulses. The old skins cannot contain the new wine. A new and universal self-awareness is struggling to be born. Its distinctive characteristic is a realization of a unity which, existing already at a deeper level, is now seeking to manifest at all levels of society. The deep urge towards unity permeates every aspect of human endeavor and creativity. That attempts to realize it at the level of politics, economics, and religion repeatedly founder on the still powerful rocks of a divisive egocentricity checks but does not extinguish the movement. For this is more than a vague outreach towards the unknown and the unattainable. It is the expression of life welling up from within the human psyche itself, the release of a new creative energy which is at the heart of all true spiritual awakening. The search and the yearning have many faces, yet all are part of a convergence, the significance of which has yet to be realized, but the time is surely ripe to give meaning, purpose, and a sense of direction to what is happening. This can only be done by those who are prepared to go the way of conscious cooperation. Central to what is happening is a growing recognition of an essential link between the human race, all sentient beings, and the planet itself. The interdependence of all life is now beyond question. The recognition of this ranges from the ecologically concerned to the mystically aware. Indeed, these two frequently appear as complementary aspects or facets of a single perception, which is that all physical manifestations of life relate to a planetary significance which goes beyond the physical. The meaning of this eruption into universal consciousness cannot be overemphasized. Indeed, its implications are enormous, for it signifies the disappearance of the old dichotomy between the material and the spiritual. This old dichotomy, so long reinforced by both science and religion, is no longer tenable. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, it is possible to see in the events of Christ's life, death, and resurrection mirror images reflecting the spiritual impulses which are endeavouring to bring humanity a stage further in its search for union with the Source. In the historical image presented by the incarnation of Christ, there is mirrored the unity of the earthly and the heavenly, a confirmation of what is now breaking into universal consciousness. For what is now happening may be seen as a cosmic reenactment of the birth of the child in Bethlehem. To see and to respond to these realities constitutes a genuine conversion, the new birth, the whole person responding to the whole Christ. The whole Christ. What is the reality conveyed by these words, the whole Christ? Does it limit or does it expand our understanding of a revealed God? Here is a paradox, focused historically, in time and space, and in the Christian religion. The incarnation of Godness is given a universal, a beyond religion significance. And it is at this very point that the perfection of Jesus' witness is demonstrated. For he pointed beyond himself to the source of light, love, and power, thus becoming the way, the truth, and the life. St. Paul takes up this very theme when he declares, "For now we know no one after the flesh. Though we have known Christ after the flesh, now we know him no more." Listen to the words of the Omega Vision, to this pointing beyond the particular to the universal. There in the once begetting of the One was shaped a clear and early promise of the whole, which must within the heart of all mankind, in time's own fullness, out of time be born. So in the Word made flesh is confirmation made of a begetting which can never cease, born of this timeless, ceaseless motion, the godlike child in everyone shall raise its head, and of a perfect love begotten, utter the holy name, I am. When St. Paul points to the mystery of the Christ within the human psyche, that is, Christ in you, the hope of glory, he is expounding that which is affirmed and confirmed in the light of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Again, St. Paul sounds this true gospel note when he says, I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. Put in another way, Jesus demonstrates at a particular point in history, at a time when human consciousness has evolved to the stage where it is capable of relating to this reality, the mystery of the God within, within the created order. And it is here that we begin to touch the mystery of the whole Christ. Wesley articulated in perfect poetic form a marvellous reality when he penned the words, Our God contracted to a span, incomprehensibly made man. But to comprehend the whole Christ, this must be expanded. Listen again to the Omega vision. What are those essences which all pervade creation? The forms they take, their giving to the whole. The life of rock, of vegetation, and of animal are, through creation's order, but a flowering forth of energy in space, faces of consciousness shown in time, which out of time rises in us to permeate the pattern. They too are giving to the whole. Their essences together are one power, a power to be distilled by us. Each occupies a field of force, where each with other interacts and drawn as by a predetermined power. All bend themselves towards the human shadow, as though into the shadow they would their ready substance yield and wait upon our seeing. Human beings then touch this mystery in the depths of their own souls. The perception and the relating are those of the individual, yet such a perceiving and relating are never individualistic. For in touching my own soul, I begin to touch not only the soul of all humanity, but of all creation. Through a particular historical revelation, I am taken beyond the particular to the universal. Focused with single-mindedness upon the Christ event in history, that is, through the revelation of Jesus of Nazareth, my consciousness expands to begin to comprehend the Christ who fills all things. A truly Christ-centered allegiance to Jesus takes us with Mary Magdalene to a letting go of Jesus and to the experience of a new vision, a vision of the Christ who fills all things. And this, all this, is for those who, in the words of Jesus, ask, seek, and knock. and to find the Christ, the whole Christ, look with the eyes of the heart. I read now The Divine Image by Blake. To mercy, pity, peace, and love, all pray in their distress, and to these virtues of delight return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God our Father dear, and mercy, pity, peace, and love is man, his child and care. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form, in heathen, Turk, or Jew, where mercy, love, and pity dwell, there God is dwelling too.